The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, Patrick Cox here, and this is one for the grammar sticklers. The last pod was about how Shakespeare turned English inside out, you know, coining new expressions like vanish into thin air and the game is up. Well, today, the backlash against Shakespeare's linguistic liberties. It was a backlash orchestrated by another poet whose birthplace I visited. The tiny, picturesque village of Aldwinkle is in a flat part of England. There's a NATO base nearby. Tim Hankins runs a farm here. Today, he's showing me Aldwinkle's most famous building, All Saints Church. Well, it used to be a church. It's closed now.
It's well maintained by the Redundant Churches Commission now.
The Redundant Churches Commission.
They run the church now.
That's fantastic. Can we have a look inside the church?
Of course you can. I've got the key.
Inside, it's a shell, empty almost. But there's a plaque on the wall that tells you that this was the place where John Dryden was baptised.
Oh yeah, John Dryden, poet laureate, born on the 9th of August 1631.
That was 15 years after Shakespeare died. Tough act to follow. Dryden's poems and plays were nothing like Shakespeare's. Where Shakespeare was evocative and inventive, Dryden was precise and refined. Among his works is the libretto for Henry Purcell's opera King Arthur. The music sounds every bit as tightly controlled as Dryden's words. John Dryden was a man of many opinions, and foremost among them was that English, like a naughty schoolboy, was behaving badly. He thought that Shakespeare and his contemporaries were not, as we think now, the leading lights in a golden age of English literature, but a bunch of punks who reveled in a showy, linguistic free-for-all. English was crying out for rules, Dryden thought. And if English didn't possess those rules, it should import them from Latin.
He held Latin to be the superior language, the language par excellence.
This is linguist David Crystal, who's co-authored a book about places of significance to the evolution of English.
The best thing English could do, he said, is to follow the elegance, the clarity, the diction, the style of the great Latin authors.
Here's one Latin-inspired idea.
You should never end a sentence with a preposition. Now it's Dryden who thinks up this rule.
A rule that even today some people insist on. Dryden thought that most of his rules, though, wouldn't stick unless they could be enforced.
The best thing to do, thought Dryden, is to follow the example of the French and institute an academy.
The Académie Française had just come into being on order from King Louis XIII to, quote, give exact rules to our language. Great idea, thought Dryden and a few other English writers.
And so a committee got together and they started to plan for an English academy that would sort of try to control the language in the way the French had tried to control theirs.
David Crystal thinks it's a good thing that Dryden and his supporters failed. For one thing, he says, academies tend to create a kind of snobbery.
If you have an academy, then you have a centralizing force, and a single variety of the language is held up as being the one that everybody should use. This means that if you speak or write the language differently, according to that view, there's something a bit inferior about that. And you certainly don't like it when some other part of the world takes your language and starts to change it in some way.
Now, of course, you don't need a language academy for that. People all by themselves will decide that they speak the Queen's whatever, and others don't. But academies help foster those attitudes. In their larger goal of controlling language, though, academies may be doomed to failure. Crystal says Dryden's conception of an English academy was misguided then, and were it to exist today, it would be completely ignored.
In Britain, for the most part, people say, well, if the Americans want to talk like that, let them talk like that. You know, anyway, what can we do about it if the Australians want to and so on? And when you think of English as a global language now, spoken by every country in the world, either as a first language or a second language or a privileged foreign language, then you could see that even if you did have an academy in England, what chance would there be of the entire population of the United States respecting the views of that academy? Or the other 2 billion people in the world who speak English as a global language?
Yeah, that linguistic cat's out of the bag. And truth be told, it was never really in the bag. English has been unruly and full of dialects from its beginnings. So why did John Dryden's English Language Academy never come into being? As it turned out, his timing was terrible. Just when he was trying to hold meetings and drum up support for the idea, the Great Plague struck, followed a year later by the Great Fire of London. There was a mass exodus from the capital. And that was that.
The steam went out of the venture. It was resuscitated a decade later, but it had gone out of fashion almost at that time.
Today, Dryden is remembered mainly for his creative writing. And the church that baptised him has been transformed into a sort of village cultural centre.
It's open to the public to use. I mean, we've had people come and do art exhibitions in here, and they've had plays down here. I think I draw a line of having discos down here.
This, again, is my guide, Tim Hankins.
And they are looking now into doing what's called champing. People can stay overnight in the churches.
That's absolutely brilliant. Champing. So that's a cross between... Yeah, it's camping in a church.
Yeah, champing. It's a new thing. I hadn't heard it until yesterday. I heard of champing.
Doesn't sound like a word John Dryden would have approved of. But that's English for you. For the world, I'm Patrick Cox. Now, if Dryden were alive today, here's a debate that he most certainly would have got stuck into. It's one of those grammar debates that involve Latin, right up his street. It comes up from time to time with a lot of us who work in journalism. We get a note from a listener or reader who points out that we are getting our Latin plurals or singulars wrong. Should you say stadiums or stadia? Referendums or referenda? It happened recently on the BBC. One of the most prominent hosts on BBC Radio, John Humphreys, referred to a bacteria. And a horde of angry listeners pounced on his sloppy usage. Okay, so maybe there's a few more of those kinds of listeners in Britain than there are in the US. But the argument they were making was that bacteria is not singular. It's plural. And if you want to use the singular, you have to say bacterium. That was their argument. Did those listeners have a point? Humphreys decided to call an expert, Cressida Ryan, a classicist from Oxford University. Here's their conversation.
So, who's right?
Well, I think everyone's right, actually, to be honest. If you want my view of thinking about it, you've got three issues. One is, what's correct Latin?
Yes.
The next is, what is correct English?
Yes.
And the third would be, what's the relationship between those two?
Right. So what's correct Latin, then, in the case of bacteria? Because I just assume that bacteria is the plural of bacterium, but we don't use bacterium any longer because even scientists themselves say it sounds rather pedantic and dated, and so why bother?
I think that's probably a fair comment, and that's also a sign that people in particular technical disciplines will use words in particular ways for them, which might not be true for the rest of the country, because English is a language that has regional dialects, temporal dialects. It has all kinds of richness to it, and it's going to use things in different ways because we're not a controlled language like, say, French is.
Right.
Fair enough, bacterium is the singular. If you wanted to refer to an individual bacterium, you would want to say that. If you wanted to talk about the class of things, then bacteria, to me, sounds like a perfectly fair thing to do.
All right, so...
say a collective noun.
Right, OK, well, that's it, isn't it? So now when we get into referendums and all that sort of thing, and stadiums, again, where do we go? Because it depends whether it's a Latin word or not.
Well, I think for me it depends whether you're using it as a Latin word you've borrowed, in which case you might want to put the Latin ending on it.
How do we know whether we...
or whether you're choosing to use it as a word that has become an English word.
Ah, well, how do
so
we know?
So if you're thinking of it as a word that has been borrowed from Latin and become English, then why not put an English ending on it?
I'm not sure we're thinking about it at all, really.
We're not, but we've all grown up with our own ways of doing things, and that's one of the ways English works. It's a constantly progressing language. And I think the more Latin you do at school, university, whatever, the more you realise how quickly linguistic change happens and how dynamic languages are. And possibly the less you worry about some aspects of that, although I admit to being a fair pedant about a lot of it myself.
Oh, are you? Ah, well, that's, yeah, that's interesting. All right, but nonetheless, what you would say is that usage, or would you, usage trumps strict grammatical accuracy, or not even grammatical accuracy. We're talking about another language here, aren't
we? Exactly. There's no strict rule book that says, in English, this is how you have to do things. Take an example like, say, syllabus.
Ah.
The Latin plural would also end in US.
Oh, so it wouldn't be syllabi?
Absolutely not. However, because everyone in English has said, oh, we know this rule that Latin plurals end in I, so we'll apply it to a word where it doesn't apply. It's become an extra category of
right,
English plural ending.
So we've made it up. Yeah.
We've made it up.
But then if we use it for the next 500 years or something, that'll be all right, won't it?
Yep. There's one other slight angle to this, is that the word bacteria is itself a Greek word and a singular.
Ah. Oh. You've silenced me.
Well done.
I tell you, there's one that I know that you're interested in and I love, and that's panini.
Yes. I took an Italian friend to lunch on Saturday and she totally unselfconsciously ordered a panino because she's Italian and that's the singular. But of course, every menu in the UK will have panini, plural paninis.
And
it.
Every Italian winces when you say, can I have a panini, please?
Right.
But nonetheless,
how many English people worry?
Well, precisely. You make the point. Well, that's great stuff. Thank you very much indeed, Cressida Ryan.
Welcome.
Thanks a lot.
So good. I don't even know where to start. If you want to hear more stories in our Evolution of English series, head to pri.org/language. There's a great interactive map there and photos of all of the people that I interviewed and places that I went to. Or you can go to the World in Words page on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter. I tweet under the name Patry Cox, PatriCox. Another pod's on the way tomorrow on John Smith, you know, the Pocahontas guy. John Smith and the globalization of English. See you then.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.